Hello, listeners. This is Iris, and we're going to read the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, March 20th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's take a look at the weather forecast for our area first thing. This coming from KCRG. The headline is, Back to Chilly Conditions with Multiple Rain and Snow Chances in the Future. Dateline Cedar Rapids. Our brief return to warmer weather is over, and we'll be headed for wetter weather soon. Temperatures this morning should dip into the 20s in many cases, with wind chills that could fall as low as the single digits to mid-10 above zero. It certainly will be another day to dress warmly, because you won't see a huge improvement in how it feels by this afternoon. Wind chills are likely to stay in the upper 20s to low 30s as air temperatures reach the upper 30s to low 40s. Bands of clouds present this morning should begin to move on by midday and beyond. Before they do, a very isolated flurry or sprinkle is possible, but a layer of dry air near the surface should prevent much of this from occurring. We'll keep it partly cloudy tonight into Thursday, too, though there may be some tendency toward cloudier skies later in the day on Thursday. Temperatures will be a handful of degrees warmer ahead of our next storm system, reaching the low to mid-40s. Winds should actually stay somewhat lighter compared to recent days. The storm system that moves through the region late this week begins the first sign of precipitation with it into our northern zones on Thursday night. This likely starts as snow north of U.S. Highway 20 and should remain as wet snow for those areas. Between U.S. Highway 30 and Highway 20, a rain and snow mix will be possible, with just plain rain most likely south of Highway 30. Precipitation will likely be ongoing during the morning commute, making for a period of potentially tricky travel conditions. Most of it should wrap up by lunchtime, though. Some snow accumulation is possible with the system, especially the farther north that you go. A band of 1 to 3 inches looks likely along and north of Highway 20, with the potential that a narrower band of somewhat higher totals could develop. South of Highway 20 to the Highway 30 corridor, a trace to an inch of wet and slushy snow is possible. Accumulation is unlikely elsewhere. Slick roads will be possible as this occurs, especially during the morning drive on Friday. It's been weeks since we've had to deal with anything like this in most of eastern Iowa, so you'll want to remember those smart winter driving techniques that include slowing down, especially while snow is falling, and give yourself extra stopping distance between your vehicle and the one in front of you. Extra stopping distance at intersections is also a good idea. Plan to give yourself a little extra time if road conditions are poor in your Friday morning commute. Temperatures should reach above freezing on Friday, with highs in the 30s and 40s likely, which would lead to at least some melting of any snow that sticks. Dry weather stays with us through Saturday, too, with clouds building again ahead of the next storm system. Another opportunity for rain and snow to end this weekend. This one brings the chance for rain and snow back into eastern Iowa, though the onset of it could be a little slow. We'll keep the chances slight on Saturday night, but it picks up more significantly on Sunday. As it appears from this far out, Sunday will have the best chance for wintry impacts in more of the area, with precipitation having a decent chance at starting out as snow for many, before it begins to shift to a mix or just rain later in the day into Sunday night. Our northern zones are again the most likely to see frozen precipitation during this time, with communities closest to the Iowa-Minnesota border hanging on to the chance the longest. Depending on the timing and track of this storm system, some snow accumulation is possible. As this weekend storm system slowly pulls through the region, the chance for precipitation continues. Rain will be the dominant precipitation type on Sunday night into essentially Monday, as warmer air gets pulled into the state. A few thunderstorms could even take place to start off next week. Temperatures will vary a decent amount as the system moves by, starting out in the 20s early on Sunday, before potentially aiming into the 40s. 50s are possible on Monday, especially the farther south you go, before colder air returns next Tuesday. That cooler air could result in any leftover precipitation mixing with or turning to snow as the storm system exits the area. Some of the latest trends in the data we use to help make our forecasts indicate that this system may be moving out a little faster early next week, which could limit wintry impacts during the tail end of it. Generally, we really encourage you to keep an eye on the weather over the next few days and be aware of additional updates about the storm system and what it will bring to eastern Iowa. We're still far enough away that the track and timing of this system could easily still see more adjustments, which would have an effect on the outcome locally. Now let's look at what the front page of the Courier has to offer today. The big headline at the top story says, Biden, lawmakers announce deal. Deadline is Friday to avoid partial government shutdown. This article comes to us from the Associated Press and begins with a photograph of President Biden and Speaker of the House Mike Johnson and other legislators as they sit around a table at a luncheon. Dateline Washington. President Joe Biden and congressional leaders announced Tuesday they reached an agreement on this fiscal year's final set of spending bills. The question is how fast lawmakers can pass the bills to avoid a partial government shutdown. While Biden said he'll sign the bill package as soon as he receives it, time is running short. Legislative staff needs time to finish the bill text, an arduous task. The House has a rule that lawmakers get 72 hours to review a bill before voting. The Senate has never been known for its ability to sprint. Meanwhile, funding for several key agencies expires at midnight on Friday. Quote, "We have come to an agreement with congressional leaders on a path forward for the remaining full-year funding bills," Biden, a Democrat, said in a statement Tuesday morning. Quote, "The House and Senate are now working to finalize a package that can quickly be brought to the floor, and I will sign it immediately," unquote. Work on the final spending bills hit a late snag around funding for the Department of Homeland Security, but the contours of the bill were resolved late Monday. House Speaker Mike Johnson, a Republican from Louisiana, said the relevant committees are drafting bill text to be considered by the full House and Senate, quote, "as soon as possible." House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries of New York issued a similar statement saying, quote, "In the next few days, upon completion of the drafting process, Congress would consider the package." The action comes nearly 6 months into the fiscal year, with Congress still only halfway home in passing spending measures expected to total about $1.65 trillion. Lawmakers passed the first spending bills in early March, representing about 30% of discretionary spending for the year. Now lawmakers are focused on the larger package and, in what has become routine, are brushing up against a shutdown deadline. The package is expected to provide about $886 billion for the Pentagon. It will also fund the Departments of Health and Human Services, Labor, and others. Overall, the two spending packages provide about 3% boost for defense while keeping non-defense spending roughly flat with the year before. That's in keeping with an agreement that former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, a Republican from California, worked out with the White House, which restricted spending for 2 years and suspended the debt ceiling into January 2025. So the federal government could continue paying its bills. House Republicans are determined to end the practice of packaging all 12 annual spending bills into one massive bill called an omnibus. They managed this time to break the spending bills into two parts. The House's 72-hour rule means the chamber would not take it up until late Friday at the earliest, just hours before funding expires. Johnson could then likely have to bring the bill up through a streamlined process requiring two-thirds support to pass. Much of the no votes are expected to come from Republicans, who are critical of spending levels as well as the lack of policy mandates such as restricting abortion access, eliminating diversity programs in federal agencies, and banning gender-affirming care. Then the Senate would act on the bill, but it would require all senators to agree on speeding up the process to get to a final vote before the midnight deadline. Such agreements generally require Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer to allow for votes on various amendments to the bill in return for an expedited final vote. Schumer said Tuesday he was hopeful of avoiding a lapse in government services. Quote, "We haven't had a government shutdown since 2019. There's no good reason for us to have one this week now that we're getting very close to finishing the job," Schumer said. One provision in the bill would provide for 12,000 special immigrant visas for eligible Afghans who helped Americans despite great risk to themselves and their loved ones during roughly two decades of war in Afghanistan. Iowa bill creates legal immunity for manufacturers of pesticides. The story written by Caleb McCullough of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau. Dateline Des Moines. Iowa Senate lawmakers advanced for the second time a bill that would protect chemical manufacturers from lawsuits over failure to warn consumers about potential adverse health effects. The bill, Senate Study Bill 3188, was supported by Bayer, the manufacturer of the glyphosate-based herbicide Roundup. Bayer has been hit by lawsuits from individuals claiming it failed to warn consumers of the potential health risks of Roundup. The company has won some lawsuits against individuals alleging Roundup caused their cancer, but in other cases, it has been found liable. Bayer spent more than $10 billion settling most pending claims in 2020. Under the bill, pesticide manufacturers could not be held liable for failing to warn consumers about adverse health effects in a way that exceeds the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency labeling requirements. The bill stipulates that the immunity would not apply to Chinese state-owned companies, singling out the massive agriculture and chemical company Syngenta. The bill was advanced by the two Republicans on a three-member subcommittee on Monday. It is eligible for a hearing in the full Senate Appropriations Committee. Bayer purchased Roundup maker Monsanto in 2018. The company has multiple crop science plants in Iowa, including a plant in Muscatine that manufactures Roundup. Lobbyists for Bayer and major farm groups supported the bill and told lawmakers on Monday it would prevent unfounded lawsuits against the company that creates a vital tool for farmers. Brad Epperly, a lobbyist for Bayer, said existing law and EPA regulations prevented Bayer from providing warnings that exceeded EPA requirements. He said complying with EPA rules satisfied the company's duty to warn. Quote, "We are not in a position where we can make that kind of warning," he said. "There's no regulatory body in the entire world who finds this carcinogenic," unquote. Bayer has said it will seek a U.S. Supreme Court ruling to determine whether state-level duty-to-warn claims are preempted by federal law. A federal appeals court in February decided that those claims can be considered and allowed a lawsuit to go forward. Glyphosate-based herbicides like Roundup have received significant scrutiny over health claims. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency found glyphosate is, quote, "not likely to be carcinogenic and has determined there are no risks of concern to human health." but a U.S. appeals court in 2022 vacated those findings for procedural reasons and required the agency to reconsider. A World Health Organization cancer agency found glyphosate in 2015 to be, quote, probably carcinogenic to humans, but European Union regulators have found that there was not sufficient evidence for that categorization. Environmental groups and some individuals objected to the bill, saying it would take away the ability of farmers to seek compensation when a company sells dangerous chemicals without proper warning. Alicia Vasto, the water program director for the Iowa Environmental Council, said that there had been other chemicals approved by the EPA that were later found to be dangerous. Quote, this bill would prevent Iowa farmers and rural residents from seeking justice in the future, Vasto said. Quote, time and time again, research has uncovered the dangers of pesticide after the EPA has declared a product safe for use, unquote. A similar bill made it partway through the lawmaking process this year before failing to pass out of either chamber before a deadline. The new bill adds the language exempting Chinese-owned companies from the immunity. A lobbyist for Syngenta, which is owned by the Chinese state-owned enterprise ChemChina, called the bill, quote, discriminatory. Kelly Patchkey, representing the Iowa trial lawyers, said the provision might be unconstitutional. Senator Mark Costello, a Republican from Imogene, who is a farmer, said he was concerned that if Bayer received too many punitive court rulings related to Roundup, farmers could lose access to the product. Costello said consumers could still sue the company over specific harms, just not over a duty to warn. Quote, if they find out they've been lying to us or misrepresenting things, or if it ends up that it really is dangerous and it's proven, then they can still sue under the statute, he said. Senator Bill Dotzler, a Democrat from Waterloo, declined to advance the bill. He said he thought there was evidence that Roundup contributed to instances of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and other cancers. Quote, I think the label should say some kind of warning that this could affect your health, he said. AEA proposal opposed by school leaders coalition passes in the Senate. Aaron Murphy wrote this story from the Courier's Des Moines Bureau. Dateline Des Moines. State House Republicans have approved two different proposals to overhaul the operation and funding of Iowa's 9 area education agencies, which provide special education services and other supports to K-12 schools. Meanwhile, separate coalitions of K-12 superintendents reached out to state lawmakers over the weekend to express their respective support for and opposition to the proposals. Iowa Senate Republicans passed their version of AEA changes Monday at the Iowa Capitol. This proposal is similar to one presented by Governor Kim Reynolds earlier this year, but significantly different from the one that Iowa House Republicans passed last month. Last weekend, a group of 32 K-12 Iowa superintendents made their feelings on both proposals clear when they emailed all state legislators to express their opposition to the plan. Quote, our message is clear. We are deeply concerned about the proposed changes to the AEAs, especially the shift towards a fee-for-service approach, states the emailed letter. Quote, the value of the AEA system as designed is that it is a cooperative that ensures that every school district, regardless of size or location, has access to the services it needs to serve students. The letter continues. Quote, rural school districts in particular rely heavily on AEAs for critical support. Disrupting a model that has largely worked over the past 50 years will have grave consequences for the students we serve, unquote. Some of the superintendents who signed the email lead Northeast Iowa school districts, including Wapsie Valley, Gladbrook, Rhinebeck, Vinton, Shellsburg, Marshalltown, Alameiki, Eastern Alameiki, Osage, and Riceville. Another group of 18 superintendents signed a letter to legislators in which they expressed support for the legislative effort to change AEA operations and funding. Quote, "We advocate for AEA reform in this session," that letter says. Quote, "We recognize the valuable role that AEAs play in supporting our schools and educators. Also, as advocates for the well-being of our students, we believe it is essential for educational systems to continually evaluate their effectiveness and identify areas for improvement," unquote. Superintendents from school districts outside of Northeast Iowa signed the letter, with Clear Creek, Amana, and College Community being the closest. Currently, state and federal funding is sent directly to the area education agencies, which provide services to school districts in their region. The AEAs are most prominently used in supporting special education students, those who have an individualized education plan, or IEP. AEAs also provide a variety of other services, such as professional development for teachers, crisis response programs, and media services. Under the Senate's bill, which is much closer aligned with our governor's proposal, AEA funding would be transitioned to a fee-for-service model, through which AEAs would provide special education and other services only if requested by a school district. That annual uncertainty, critics of the proposal say, would jeopardize the entire AEA system. Both proposals create a new AEA oversight division in the Iowa Department of Education. The House version keeps the current funding structure largely in place. State funding for special education services would go to the school districts, and they would be required to use that funding with the AEAs. Iowa needs assistance. Senate Republicans approved their proposal, an amended version of Senate File 2386, on Monday. Only Republicans voted in favor of the bill, while 6 Senate Republicans joined all Democrats in voting against it. Senator Waylon Brown, Mike Klimisch, Mark Lofgren, Charlie McClintock, Sandy Salmon, and Jeff Taylor. During Senate debate, Senator Lynn Evans, a Republican from Orillia, and former teacher, principal, and superintendent, said the changes are needed because the U.S. Department of Education has since 2018 categorized Iowa as, quote, "needs assistance" under the Federal Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. Quote, "This bill's about ensuring that our children with disabilities receive the best possible services in education. The goal is to get the best return on investment for the delivery of special education services to the kids who need them," Evans said. Quote, "This is the right direction to go. We need more local control on how these dollars are spent," unquote. Senate Democrats proposed pausing the AEA reforms and establishing a task force to spend a year studying the agencies and making recommendations to lawmakers before next year's legislative session. They criticized Republicans for not listening to the outpouring of educators and parents who have expressed opposition to the AEA proposals and the process by which the legislation has been proposed and passed. Democrats pointed to a recent Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll, which showed 56% of Iowans have a favorable view of AEAs. Quote, "State House Republicans have once again maybe listened, but they did not hear their constituents. Because if they heard their constituents in Iowa, they told them resoundingly to not do anything to this AEA system," Senator Molly Donahue, a Democrat from Cedar Rapids, who has worked for 43 years as a special education teacher, said during debate. Donahue said she had benefited from AEA services as a special education teacher and as a child when she spoke with a lisp. Quote, "The fact is, I wouldn't be standing here talking to anybody at all had I not had those services, Donahue said. Reynolds has said the AEA system needs updating and has claimed that Iowa special education students are falling behind other states. And although the test scores she has used as an example are also used by the federal government, the company that designs the test has said the scores should not be used to inform policy changes. Reynolds's administration hired a consultant to review the AEA system and recommend changes, a process that Democrats roundly criticized as biased. Quote, I want to thank the Senate for their commitment to improving special education and acknowledging that the AEA system needs reform, Reynolds said in a statement. Quote, I now look forward to working with the House and Senate to reach a compromise that will bring transparency, accountability, and consistency to the AEA system, while most importantly, improving outcomes for students with disabilities, unquote. Under the Senate bill, starting in the 2025-26 school year, 90% of the funding for special education would go directly to the school districts, which would be free to use that funding to contract for special education services through an AEA or a private company. The remaining 10% would go to the AEAs. Under the Senate bill, in the 2024-25 school year, 60% of the funds for media and education services would go directly to the school districts, which again could use those funds to contract with AEA or a private company. The remaining 40% would go to the AEAs. Starting in the 2025-26 school year, all media and education services funding would remain with school districts, and none of it would go to the AEAs. The Senate bill also proposes raising the minimum salary for new Iowa teachers to $46,251, which they say is the current statewide average for starting teachers' salaries. House Republicans addressed teacher and other education staff salaries in a separate bill, and they proposed raising the starting teacher minimum to $50,000, matching the figure proposed by Reynolds, phased in over 2 years. House Republicans also proposed dedicating more funding to help schools increase veteran teacher salaries and create a $15 per hour minimum wage for education support staff. In her statement, Reynolds called for legislation that will increase salaries for both starting and veteran teachers. House Republicans passed their AEA bill, House File 2612, on February 29th, with a 53-41 vote. Only Republicans supported the bill, and 9 Republicans joined all Democrats in voting against it. With both Republican-led chambers having approved their respective AEA bills, leaders from each chamber and Reynolds will need to reach an agreement on a proposal that can pass both chambers and be signed into law by Reynolds. Cedar Falls SWAT team called out to reports of shots fired. No one was injured. Story by Courier staff. Dateline Cedar Falls. Police officers responded to a report of shots fired early Thursday in the 400 block of North Division Street. The Cedar Falls SWAT team was called to assist with the incident, which occurred around 2 a.m. Details weren't available, but no one was injured, and one person was transported to the hospital for evaluation. The incident remains under investigation. Cedar Falls Public Safety was assisted by Blackhawk County Consolidated Dispatch, the Blackhawk County Sheriff's Office, and Mercy One paramedics. Now, listeners, we just take a moment to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, March 20th on IRIS, that's IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the blind and the print handicapped. Now, this message.
Not completing high school is more of a social thing than it was an academic thing. Even though all these years have passed, I still had that longing to have my diploma.
At age 30, Carissa finished her high school diploma.
If you're even considering getting your high school diploma, you can do it.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. That's finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Now, let's turn to the opinion section. Today, our first editorial comes from a Lawrence native named Dick Hakes, and it was published first in the Storm Lake Times Pilot. The title is, The Wake-Up Call, 75 Has Come to Stay. A few days ago, I woke up to an astounding thing. Some 75-year-old guy was staring back at me from the bathroom mirror. Wow, I said to myself, just wow. Honestly, I never expected to make it this far. Genes rule, and mom, dad, and two brothers died in their 60s, which means I've been on bonus time for a while now. Bonus time is okay. It's still time. But how, by the thunderbolt of Zeus, did this happen? Wasn't I still that high school kid in the Lawrence Elks letter jacket who snickered at the crotchety old farmers on the spit and whittle bench downtown and cringed when an elderly relative grabbed my elbow for yet another mega-boring story from the Great Depression? Now I'm them. That is so vividly apparent when I see my grandkids' eyes glaze over in the midst of one of my treasured stories about growing up in small-town Iowa. Stories like how we used to crawl out on the porch roof on hot summer nights, lie on our backs, stare at the stars, and look for Sputnik. Or how we used to have epic dirt clod battles at the gravel pit. Or like how delivering the Des Moines Tribune on my bike every day after school taught me how to manage money and deal with people. The good ones and the nasty tightwads as well. That's fascinating stuff, right? Why would any young kid want to sneak a glance at TikTok on the phone in their lap during a nice family 75th birthday dinner when Grandpa is literally chock full of such enlightenment? Ah, yes. Now we have touched on what could be the great tragedy of being 75. You have these huge buckets of life-enhancing advice and stories carefully accumulated over three-quarters of a century, and nobody to force them on but the dog. And yet, at 75, a guy cannot complain. True, there are a few strange physical things going on these days. You might pick up a little ailments nobody has ever heard of and can barely spell, like essential thrombocythemia or polymyalgia rheumatica, treatable, mostly controllable things that you can deal with thanks to modern medicine, but which put you on a first-name basis with your phlebotomist. And of course, there's all the other normal old people stuff, like dealing with hearing aids, cataracts, titanium knees, and the multitude of discouraging age spots, skin tags, squamous cell carcinomas, and other unpleasantries, which keep your dermatologist buying name-brand groceries instead of the generic knockoffs. The harsh truth is that in your mid-70s, things just seem to be slip-sliding away, as once foretold in song by our old buddy Paul Simon. The next target down the road is 80, which, unlike the first seven decades ending in zero, seems to mark the point at which just plain old becomes seriously old. So, at 75, I guess you just keep on keeping on. The good news is, I'm a lucky boy. I'm still upright most of the time, can walk at the pond, can drive to coffee, can still write a mildly cohesive sentence, and have not totally alienated the wife, yet. And truly, if you can still recognize, appreciate, and hug those you love, including those eye-rolling adolescent grandkids around the dining room table, well, life remains good. Those stinkers, sometimes they laugh at me, and sometimes they laugh with me, but we're all still laughing. And that's what counts. Now from the editorial page of the Des Moines Register, to keep Iowa school kids safe from guns, look to research, not more guns. A proposal at the State House to allow teachers and other school employees to carry weapons and to subsidize security guards is the wrong approach to keep Iowa children safe. But it's difficult to articulate alternatives that are both effective and realistic in the wake of 3 deadly school shootings in central Iowa in less than 3 years. Expert research suggests a sad truth. No set of policies can provide much assurance so long as it remains easy for children to acquire firearms. That's not fatalism. State officials, school boards, school administrators, and other educators, parents, and guardians, all of them and more, can and should take actions that might make it less likely a child will be shot on school grounds. But it's maddening to realize that so many interventions are, for practical purposes, off the table anytime soon because of the sheer number of guns in circulation and the prevailing political attitude that almost no benefit could ever justify the slightest complication for people to acquire and carry firearms. What should be done in the here and now? 4 steps could make the difference. 1, listen to the research. Research on mass shootings in general and at schools in particular is plentiful, although one hurdle to applying it is widespread suspicion of political motives behind any research involving guns in the United States. If the Secret Service is a relatively neutral arbiter, its 2020 report on targeted school violence provides both some help and some sobering realism about perpetrators. Quote, there is no profile of a student attacker, nor is there a profile for the type of school that has been targeted, the authors wrote. Attackers usually had multiple motives. The report adds that many attackers were victims of bullying and had exhibited psychological, behavioral, or developmental symptoms. Many used firearms they got from their homes. The studies on protecting schools do not illuminate a clear direction. Access to schools should be controlled, but going significantly further to make buildings into fortresses can be outrageously expensive and deliver other negative effects for students' psyches. Experts raise similar concerns about the cost and message of metal detectors. And of course, such building measures would not have stopped a drive-by shooting outside East High School that killed a teenager and injured others. Last month's attack at Perry High School occurred before the start of the school day in a common area. Based on what is publicly known, it is not clear even in hindsight whether access limits might have made any difference. The bottom line? Doing something just to do something could be a net negative. School safety actions should have evidence to support them. 2, reject adding more guns to the mix. Debate in Iowa for over a year now has centered on putting weapons in the hands of school staff members. It was a bad idea when the 2023 debate centered on whether insurers were right to threaten to drop schools' coverage if they armed staff. This year, House File 2586 would authorize employees of public and private schools, colleges, and universities to carry weapons. 2 separate issues are involved here. The easier to deal with is intervention, a teacher or other employee using a gun to stop an attacker. It's absolutely true that this might be beneficial. Sometimes a good guy with a gun does stop a bad guy with a gun. Unfortunately, a good guy with a gun might also make a mistake in securing the weapon, leading to a tragic accident. Perhaps a staff member will overreact to a situation or miss the target when firing. Some children might be less comfortable in class knowing it does or might contain a deadly firearm. The possibility of a successful intervention doesn't outweigh the downsides. School shootings often play out in seconds. In Perry, and at the Starts Right Here charter school in January 2023, how likely is it that armed personnel would have been in the right place to avert bloodshed? Advocates say deterrence is just as important. Shooters are attracted to gun-free zones, the argument goes, and might think twice if Iowa were to pass a law permitting adults in schools to be armed and encouraging districts to employ trained security staff. That puts a lot of faith in often suicidal shooters to act rationally. At best, the deterrence argument provides more support for hardening buildings to restrict access, not for having adults roaming the halls ready to open fire. Amid bureaucratic delays, most of $75 million that Iowa set aside in June 2022 to upgrade safety at school buildings has not yet been spent. The Associated Press reported that last month. Number 3. Work to secure weapons. There are way too many guns in America. Iowa is not about to change that. But we can change the culture to demand that adults secure their weapons, similar to how society's tide turned against smoking or going without a seatbelt. According to a database study by the federal government's National Institute of Justice, 80% of people who carried out a mass shooting at a kindergarten to 12th grade school took the firearm they used from a relative. Even parents and guardians who teach responsible gun use to children should not extend their trust to letting children get firearms out themselves. This is a place where throwing money at a problem might produce results. Many biometric gun safes that require an owner's fingerprint before opening retail for under $100. A state that has a multi-billion dollar budget surplus and forks over hundreds of millions of dollars a year for families to spend on private school, can afford to make these freely available to gun owners, removing any excuse for leaving weapons for kids to take. And number 4, don't be a stranger. Almost everybody agrees that children's mental health services in Iowa are far from adequate. Leaders are working on legislation to address that complicated problem. But we can't sit back and do nothing until the state has recruited more psychiatrists trained to help children. Each of us can reach out to help a struggling young person. It's not easy to tell in advance, with precision, whether a teenager might become a physical danger to other people. But speaking up in response to warning signs, such as disturbing social media posts, could help. It's impossible to calculate how often somebody showing interest and a troubled student averts a mass shooting. In Michigan, a jury decided this month that a woman was criminally liable for not doing anything before her son shot 4 classmates to death with a pistol his parents had bought him as a gift. We need not be bystanders until after a horror show emerges. The Institute for Justice notes the complication that some students will fear discussing concerns about a classmate, lest they be labeled a snitch. Still, talking about warning signs might sometimes protect others and convey that someone cares even a little. Could all of this make parents and guardians feel confident that their child won't be the next one murdered at school? Probably not. That will require a seismic shift in the availability of guns, but this is a place to start. Next, we have the Stray Thoughts column written by Randy Evans. This one is titled, Regardless of Party, Irresponsible is Still Irresponsible. Like many people who call this state home, I have long taken an interest in the careers and achievements of people who have gotten their start in Iowa. As a kid, I was fascinated to walk through that two-room cottage in West Branch, knowing a president of the United States, Herbert Hoover, was born there. Having grown up at the start of the space age, I have marveled at the achievements of Peggy Whitson, whose record-breaking space career was launched in Beaconsfield and the public schools of Mount Air. And more recently, I have been amazed by the talents of Caitlin Clark, the University of Iowa basketball wizard who has drawn attention from fans around the globe. All of this may help explain why I have paid more than passing attention to Democrat Katie Porter, a member of the U.S. House of Representatives from California, and why I was greatly disappointed by her outlandish, baseless comments after she lost the recent California primary election for an open U.S. Senate seat. Porter's roots run back to the soil of southern Iowa, a few counties west of where I came from. Now 50, she grew up on a farm outside of Creston during the farm crisis of the 1980s. Her father, Dan, was a farmer and banker. Her mother, Liz, is the Porter of Fonz and Porter's Love of Quilting magazine and public television fame. Katie Porter received her bachelor's degree from Yale University and her law degree from Harvard University. Before being elected to Congress in 2018, she interned for U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley and later taught law, including several years at the University of Iowa, before she moved on to the University of California, Irvine Law School. In Congress, the mother of three quickly developed a reputation as a member whose focus was on consumers and middle-class Americans, not the well-heeled interests of corporations and their executives. Using a whiteboard and a marker to make her points or highlight evidence, she proved to be an aggressive, effective interrogator of government officials and corporate executives when they were called to testify at congressional hearings. Along the way, she also wrote a best-selling book called I Swear, Politics is Messier Than My Minivan. That van bears the license plate Oversight, spelled O-V-R-S-I-T-E. Porter has many fans. Actress Whoopi Goldberg wrote on the dust jacket of the book, quote, "When Representative Katie Porter speaks, I know she knows what she's talking about and gives it to you straight up," unquote. That is because of Porter's reputation as a no-nonsense speaker that I was especially disappointed by her comments following her loss to another California Democrat, Adam Schiff, in the March 5th primary election. Porter spotted off following her loss, sounding too much like a former president. She said billionaires had rigged the election in Schaff's favor through what she called dishonest means, a reference to ads critical of her that were paid for by interest groups favoring Schiff. Porter could have thanked voters who supported her. She could have expressed her appreciation to voters in her House district who had chosen her to represent them for the past 6 years. She could have congratulated Schiff and wished him well in the November election when he faces Republican Steve Garvey, a former Major League Baseball player. She could have accepted her defeat with grace and gone home to rest and reflect on what she wants to do in the next chapter of her life. The way farmers in Iowa reflect on low crop prices or lousy weather. You can dislike the campaign finance laws, as Porter does. You can believe political groups have outsized voices because of their ability to spend staggering amounts of so-called dark money, as Porter does. And you can believe you would have been a better senator than Schiff, as Porter surely does. But using words like rigged and dishonest is wrong in so many ways. As anyone who has been listening for the past 4 years understands, a Harvard-educated lawyer with Southern Iowa common sense should understand that. Porter should realize her rash comments made without evidence only helped to further undermine public confidence in our election system. The comments have seriously eroded her reputation as an important voice in American politics and have added to the unhealthy rhetoric that saturates our nation. Her angry words are all too reminiscent of the comments by people like Donald Trump, Arizona's Carrie Lake, an Eldridge, Iowa native, by the way, MyPillow founder Mike Lindell, and other Republicans who continue to make fact-free claims Trump defeated Joe Biden in 2020. Steve Shale, a longtime Democratic strategist in Florida, told PolitiFact a political news and fact-checking website, quote, "There is nothing more important to our democracy than people acknowledging they lose elections," unquote. Michael Thorning of the Bipartisan Policy Center, a nonprofit organization, wrote on the social media site formerly known as Twitter that Porter's comments were, quote, "completely irresponsible and unserious," unquote. Too often, we Americans are quick to point out the flaws and mistakes by politicians we oppose, but are too blind to similar flaws and mistakes by politicians we support. Katie Porter's embarrassing display after this month's election should not be defended by her fellow Democrats any more than Trump's post-election nonsense should be defended by his fellow Republicans. Irresponsible is still irresponsible, regardless of the party affiliation of the person making such wild accusations. Next, from New York Times, an opinion piece written by Michelle Goldberg titled, "The Internet is a Wasteland, So Give Kids Better Places to Go." In January, I had the odd experience of nodding along with Senator Lindsey Graham, who can usually be relied on to be wrong, as he berated supervillain Mark Zuckerberg, head of Facebook's parent company, Meta, about the effect its products have on kids. Quote, "You have blood on your hands," said Graham. That evening, I moderated a panel on social media regulation whose participants included New York's Attorney General, Letitia James, a progressive crusader, and perhaps Donald Trump's single most effective antagonist. Her position wasn't that different from that of Graham, a South Carolina Republican. "There is a correlation," she pointed out, "between the proliferation of addictive social media algorithms and the collapse of young people's mental health, including rising rates of depression, suicidal thoughts, and self-harm." Quote, "And I've seen that for myself," she said, describing helping the family of a young girl find a scarce psychiatric bed during the pandemic. Quote, "She talked to me a lot about social media," unquote. Because alarm over what social media is doing to kids is broad and bipartisan, the social psychologist Jonathan Haidt is pushing on an open door with his important new book, The Anxious Generation: How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. The shift in kids' energy and attention from the physical world to the virtual one, Haidt shows, has been catastrophic, especially for girls. Female adolescence was nightmarish enough before smartphones, but apps like Instagram and TikTok have put popularity contests and unrealistic beauty standards into hyperdrive. Boys, by contrast, have more problems linked to overuse of video games and porn. The studies Haidt cites, as well as the one he debunks, should put to bed the notion that concern over kids and phones is just a modern moral panic akin to previous generations' hand-wringing over radio, comic books, and television. But I suspect that many readers won't need convincing. The question in our politics is less whether these ubiquitous new technologies are causing widespread psychological damage, then what can be done about it? So far, the answer has been not much. The Federal Kids Online Safety Act, which was recently revised to allay at least some concerns about censorship, has the votes to pass the Senate, but hasn't even been introduced in the House. In the absence of federal action, both red and blue states have tried to enact their own laws to safeguard kids online, but many have been enjoined by courts for running afoul of the First Amendment. Lawmakers in New York are working on a bill that tries to rein in predatory social media apps while respecting free speech. It targets the algorithms that social media companies use to serve kids ever more extreme content, keeping them glued to their phones. But while the law seems likely to pass, no one knows whether courts will uphold it. There are, however, small but potentially significant steps local governments can take right now to get kids to spend less time online, steps that raise no constitutional issues at all. Phone-free schools are an obvious start, although, in a perverse American twist, some parents object to them because they want to be able to reach their kids if there's a mass shooting. More than that, we need a lot more places, parks, food courts, movie theaters, even video arcades, where kids can interact in person. If we want to start getting kids offline, we need to give them better places to go instead. Local professors and students uncover plenty of uses for AI. Andy Malone wrote this story. Being nice to technology has taken on a whole new meaning in the ChatGPT era. Before the November 2022 introduction of the chatbot, sparking the artificial intelligence craze. Quote, technology nice may have meant putting a case around a smartphone or not overloading a laptop with too many files. But Hawkeye Community College professors, among many in higher education embracing AI, have found that literally being polite while communicating with ChatGPT has its benefits. Don't just give it orders, and you'll have better results, says Seth Vickers, an instructional designer helping professors use AI and create relevant guidelines in the classroom. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, March 20th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can listen to a recording of this reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state that we read. Just visit our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.